Hello everybody, James here in this Ask Dutch Anything, episode 36, I think. And we're going to do the very, very quick version of the plugs. And just so you know, this is the episode where you get to ask the Dirty Dutchman anything you wish within reason, of course, at questionsfordutch@gmail.com. That is how you submit the questions. So, very quickly, we're on Pro Wrestling Tees. Please buy our stuff there. I've got two books, Owen Hart and The Rock. Dutch has got two books, The World According to Dutch and Tales from a Dirt Road, unsigned on Amazon and signed, going to Dirty Dutchman Tale with two L's at gmail.com as he eats an enormous strawberry. And also he's got diplomas for sale that he will sign to your Dirty Dutchman Tale with two L's at gmail.com as well, and hats and all that kind of thing. As we said on Friday that we missed Ask Dutch Anything for 1 week only, and now we're back. So here we go. The first question. It was submitted to questionsfordutch@gmail.com. It's from Michael Sanders. Hi, Dutch and James. We've clearly seen some pretty terrible character gimmicks utilised within professional wrestling. Some have, against all expectations, done quite well. So with this in mind, I'd like to ask Dutch a two-part question. I'll ask you just the first part first. Number one, what's the worst gimmick you heard about from him or another talent that's thankfully never saw the light of day?
Well, most of the gimmicks that I saw that never saw the light of day would be in the smaller territories, but I can't remember one. But the one that I remember as the biggest one that did see the light of day, I changed your question around just a little bit, was what's that Easter egg deal? And
the gobbledygooker, yeah. Hector Guerrero.
Oh, my God. And it was a bad gimmick, but I had to laugh at it. It's a gimmick that you wouldn't forget. And I don't know how they would have worked. Did the gobbledygooker ever have any matches or no?
He did, yeah. I'm not sure if they were ever on TV, but he had some house show matches. Hector Guerrero did, in the outfit.
Yeah, Hector's a good guy. He would have done a good job with it, as any of those Guerrero boys would have done. They were all good guys. Hector, I was with him. I forgot where I was with him at. Oh, in TNA. Good guy. But I knew him before then, but he was a really good guy. Funny. And he's very religious now, so I wanted to engage him in a biblical conversation one time, but decided against it because some people, when they get involved in that, they just keep going and going and going, and I would have no answer, and he'd have all of them. But anyway, that was the gobbledygooker. Don't have nothing to do with religion, by the way. The gobbledygooker was probably the worst one I ever saw. And the ones that didn't make TV, I don't know. I may not have seen them.
There's one that did make the house shows in WCW, but I don't think it made TV, was when Harlem Heat debuted in WCW in like 93, and they had Colonel Robert Parker leading them out in chains. Robert Fuller, I should say, for you.
But they didn't do that. Did they do that?
1993, not 1824.
Well, that surprises me, and I think I've heard of this before. And Robert would have been the one to do with it because he was riding wearing that old Southern plantation outfit, white, and wore a hat and like a little bow tie type deal. What surprises me is Booker went along with it. You know, a lot of the guys, they don't think that's entertaining, nor, and I don't either. But I don't know I don't even know who got it through, but that made TV.
No, only made the house show loop. Never made TV, I think.
Well, that was the reason, because of the, you know, this racism didn't come along yesterday. And they don't want to see it on TV.
Do you know who the Booker was? Do you know who the Booker was?
Or now. Who was the Booker? Ole?
It was somewhere between Ole Anderson and Bill Watts. So,
God.
So a couple of the usual suspects then who you might think come up with that.
Oh yeah, well I can see it, but anyway, but that was a bad angle. That really was.
The second part of the question, if I can, I'm going to leave the thing. If you could bring your microphone just a bit closer to you as well.
Okay.
What's the worst gimmick that Dutch thought would be doomed to failure, but actually turned out to be way more successful than he initially thought? Kind regards.
Well, you're talking about an expanse of time that took in 40, 45 years that I actually saw these different gimmicks. You'd almost have to give me a list, because just thinking off the top of my head, see, I forget things that aren't regularly requested. So I've kind of forgotten the tag teams that would actually be remembered on a national basis. I've seen a lot of bad tag teams. I've seen a lot of them, but I'm afraid I don't have an answer for you there.
No, I'll tell you what, if you write back in, what was your damn name, Mike Sanders, give us a list of some of the worst characters, worst gimmicks that you think that were actually successful, and then Dutch will answer it back for you. Next question. It's funny you mentioned tag teams. Monte Carlo has written in and says, I vividly remember a pair of blonde, pale jobbers named Bill and Randy Mulkey, who wrestled almost every week on Superstation WTBS in the mid to late 80s. Every tag team from the Road Warriors to the Midnight Express to the Horsemen took turns obliterating them on national television. Then one day, a monster tag team from the West Coast had their debut match on TV, and the Mulkeys somehow defeat them for their very first ever victory. I was ecstatic. Dutch, what do you remember of the Mulkeys? How respected they were in the locker room, and can you speak to the importance of jobbers back in the 80s for putting over talent? Before we do any of this, do you even fancy watching that video where the Mulkeys get the win?
Yeah, I was there, I think.
Oh.
I was around, maybe not there, but I actually saw it when it happened.
Okay, 1 second, I'll tee it up for you. Right, so I've got the video teed up, but Dutch and I were arguing over who this could possibly be under the mask. So the fella who posted it has said it was none other than George South and Gary Royal, but you think it might be someone else, Dutch?
Yeah, I thought it might be Joel Deaton and another partner of his called something Alexander. I don't remember his first name yet. But you're right. It could have been George South and the other guy. So,
well, let's have a look at George South and the other guy. Oh, hang on. We just missed him. So this is the Mulkey Brothers versus the Gladiators.
Oh, very good. Now, they, up to this point, had never won a match. They've never even smelled a match up to this point.
Never smelled a tanning bed.
No. That's right. They look like John and George Winter. The Winter Brothers, remember them?
No, I don't.
They were musicians. They were so white. So white. And I knew these guys pretty good. They were from Anderson, South Carolina. And they knew where I was from, so they kept bringing it up, you know, and talking about South Carolina. And they were good guys. And they came over there as just to put somebody over, and they kind of caught on because they got beat week after week after week, and the people kind of liked them, so they finally put them in the Crockett Cup as one of the 13 or 14 teams they had, and they could go to Greensboro now and be in that tournament. And I bet they got a pretty good crowd reaction when they appeared.
Mm-hmm. See what they got to say.
You know, people, they like to see a loser win sometime.
So every
he
loser
picks
wins.
Him up. Now, see, they didn't really win this. He just tripped over the guy, which was a good finish, and he fell down. And the referee is looking around. Oh, my God. A pin. And he hop in there.
Who's the referee?
I forgot his name now, too. But
here we go. Look at that. Look at those bodies.
Oh, yeah,
they don't
man.
Even look like brothers, yet somehow they do.
Oh, yeah. Well, they blinded their hair. They have never even walked by a gym. You know, if they see the gym, and they just keep going down to the next little restaurant or something. But it didn't matter because the people liked them. They couldn't go too far in it. But they would give the people a little bit of hope that maybe these guys... Maybe these guys will win one day and win one when it counts. So I would like to see their one loss record. Somebody has it somewhere.
Let's
what do you think that would be?
Oh, in the thousands to, sorry, be zero to thousand or one to thousand. Let's just listen. Hang on, this is Mulky Mania, wasn't it?
Yeah,
right now, here we go.
We just got our major break. And when we come to Baltimore, we want to see all the Monkey Mania sign because we're going to hit the town hot and heavy. Okay, Randy and Bill Monkey and Monkey Mania is coming to Baltimore in the tournament.
They didn't have to take their tops off.
Well,
no one asked them to take their tops off there.
Well, they did. But it's.
Didn't they just?
Those might have been the days, but I guess the tanning beds are still. We're still coming into vogue. What year was that, you think?
86, something like that.
Yeah, they were around. So, but they never decided to get into it. But they were kind of over you could take it. They was trying to build them a little bit because they had beat them so much. The people knew who they were. So give them a win, put them in this, and now we can see if we can get somebody to watch their matches against a team that just won't kill them. Which was good booking, I thought.
So there's a lot of jobber questions, or enhancement talent questions, excuse me. Marty from Tuplo, Mississippi, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I've just got MS. Anyway, not multiple
sclerosis. Hey, that's the town Elvis is from.
Oh, Tupelo, really?
Well, not exactly in Tupelo, but right outside Tupelo.
And also he's, where there's mustard up the walls. As
yeah,
said.
He's associated with Tupelo, but that's Elvis's town.
Hey, Dutch and James, long-time listener but first time asking a question. I've been a fan of Dutch throughout his career. I watched a lot of Memphis wrestling back in the day, and I loved every minute of it. Not all wrestlers made it to the top of the business and were relegated, to a career of being an enhancement talent. One tag team that I saw for years in Memphis was Rough and Ready, an African-American team. They always took a beating and kept on going week after week. Does Dutch remember these guys, and can he maybe give a little insight on them, what it would have been like for guys like these that stayed in the same territories their whole career, and what kind of money they would have been making to keep them coming back, putting their bodies on the line for little pay?
Rough and Ready was the African-American equivalent of the Mulkey Brothers in Atlanta. And I like these guys. And, of course, Memphis had really more of a reason to put the Rough and Ready in there because the black population around Memphis is pretty high. I would say between 50 and 60%. And that's not their whole viewing range, but a lot of black people in that area. And they would go in there. And they would bust their ass. They weren't very big. And they were really, really just talking to them in the back. I don't know them that well, but they always very friendly. And they just wanted to go in there and have a good match, no matter who it was with. And they loved when they had a match with Bobby Eaton. Because Bobby Eaton would, they were like baby faces, the Rough and Ready. But Bobby Eaton would give them these high-ass moves that made them look great. He'd take a big backdrop and a double drop kick, and he'd do all that stuff with these guys because they could do it. So, and these guys could do all the moves. You just had to call it for them. But they were kind of over for a while, but you just can't keep beating somebody and expect to give them a reaction. I think they tried to do a swerve on them by doing the Mulkey angle, by putting them over, and it's like anything else. It works for a while, then they fade away. And if they had stayed in the business, where would they have ended up? I don't really foresee those guys staying in the business. I don't think they could have made enough money to stay in the business. So, regrettably, they were forced to go get a 9-to-5 or an 8-to-4 job, and that's where. And I don't know what happened to them.
Do you know how much they would have been paid, likely, at the time?
Weekly. They've been paid weekly.
Very weekly.
Very very weekly. No, they couldn't have. How much were they paid back in those days to make TV?
Mm-hmm.
$25. Now, $25 in 1980, well, that's like 50. I guess it'd be $75 to $100 now. But... yeah, that won't go too far. Really.
Did they ever do house shows? Did they ever get put on the weekly tours, or were they only for TV?
Not very much. Every now and then, they would get put on a Memphis card, I think, or a Jackson card. they would send them to cards within, I'll say, 100 miles of Memphis. I was putting them in Nashville. It wouldn't have paid enough for them to go. They wouldn't have made much money. So they made the right choice.
Next question. Shane says, do you have any stories on Sir Oliver Humperdinck?
Matter of fact, I do. Have I ever told this story? No, I'm asking you.
I'm not sure we've ever talked about Oliver Humperdinck before.
Okay.
So I'm looking forward to this.
So I was in Florida, and we went to a 7-Eleven. It was me and Oliver Humperdinck and another guy who I don't remember his name, but he wasn't around long. We went to 7-Eleven. They wanted to get some beer, and I wanted to maybe get a Coke or something to drink, not beer. But on the way in, there was this big, I mean, massive guy. He had to weigh 280. And I was trying to go through the door. I weighed maybe then 210. And I tried to go through the door, and I went this way, and he went that way. He blocked me. So I tried to go back the other way. He went that way. See, my camera's working now, right?
Perfect.
So
time.
I go back here in the middle, and he just stays there. And I says, can I get in? He says, what do you want to go in there for? I said, because I want to go into the store. Do you mind moving? And he said, I ain't going to move. And, you know, it's like one of those standoffs that, how am I going to get in the store? This guy's big. So finally, I don't know how it came down to it, but we just threw down. I'm punching him. I think I tried to punch him first. And he punched back and never hit me. I got him just a couple shots, but he was sneaking ass drunk. And I remember Humperdinck in the car, oh no, Dutch, watch out. He was a hell of a damn cheering crowd. And I remember, you know, the old stands they used to have, the old newspaper stands?
Oh, yeah.
Well, they had one. It was like a Tampa Tribune. And we locked up, and at a 7-Eleven, you know, you got those big windows, and we worked our way down till we got to that newspaper box, and we both went heads over heels over top of it. But what happened, it caught my ear on the bottom. It like tore half of it off. And then we messed around there a little bit, and, you know, we pull and tug, and I'm punching, he's trying to punch. And then the cops come up. And the cops come up, and it's almost like he was with me. I said, cops are here. And he stopped. And I stopped. We both stopped just by saying the cops are here. And as one cop got out of the car, and Humperdinck said, oh, well, no, it's okay, officer. It's okay. He never tried to involve himself in it. But Bonnie said, what are you boys doing? I says, oh, we're just wrestling around. I'm a wrestler. We went to the high school tonight. We had a wrestling match. Well, you don't need to bring it out here on the streets. I said, well, you know, I'm trying to tell him. And the guy said, well, what happened to you? He said, yeah, it's like he said, we were wrestling. And he adopted my excuse. And finally, the cop said, get in the car and get out of town as fast as you can. If I see you again, I'm going to arrest you. And I remember Humperdinck going, oh, well, thank you, sir. And all he did, that's all he added into it. But I don't know if he'd ever seen a fight in his life. And I don't know why it broke down into the fight. He just wouldn't get out of my way, and he's being a smartass. But that's how I remember Oliver Humperdinck. And he was a really smart guy. Great. If you talk to him in the car about anything, he knew about a lot of things. He may not knew everything, but he knew a lot to have a hell of a conversation with. And I enjoyed being around him. But I always remember that he was in a passenger in the car when I got in the fight with this damn big Florida redneck. And I actually wrote about it in my book. Yeah. So that's what I remember Oliver Humperdinck for.
There you go, then. So if you like, this is a good place to plug it. If you want more stories like that, go to Dirty Dutchman, tell it two L's with two L's at gmail.com and get yourself a signed version of one of those books. And there's plenty more stories in there for you. So we'll move on. Gregory Krug says, James and Dutch, I heard a Bill Eadie interview where he mentioned how, when he wrestled as the Masked Superstar, he had to wrestle differently to express his emotions because his mask obscured all his facial expressions. My question, when Dutch wrestled masked wrestlers, did he have to change anything to accommodate for his opponent's mask? Thank you.
Not really. But see, the masked wrestler, his face only really comes into question when he's trying to sell something. You know, sometimes if a guy doesn't have a mask on, he gets a slam or he gets a punch and his face is going to tell the story. If it goes, oh, God. But he doesn't have that. A mask wrestler has to sell with his body. So if he gets punched in the gut, he's got to come this, oh, you know, and he's going to make the face automatically, I think. But his body is going to tell the story. And I've worked under the hood. Working on the hood is not easy, really. But when I worked on a hood, I was Dutch Mantell's cousin from Altraw, Texas. My cousin was called Texas Dirt from Dirt, Texas. And the reason he came into being in Memphis, I had lost a loser leave town to Dream Machine. And my cousin answered the call because Dream Machine was tarnishing the family name. And we did an interview with him in Texas. Of course, it was me underneath the hood. I said I was coming to Memphis to to revive the name and not make the Mantells a laughing stock. And we went with that for about, I don't know, 4 weeks. And then finally I took the hood off and we were back to normal.
I've seen the video where you would disappear. Didn't you disappear in a car and said, goodbye, everybody, I'm going now, or something like that?
Yeah, I did that. That was when Texas Dirt drove up. I said, what was it? Me, I drove up in Texas Dirt. I don't know. I forgot what it was. But we did it way out in the country in a cornfield. I remember that, hot as hell. But those are the things people remember. You remembered it. Now, you're thinking, what in the hell is Dutch doing out in the middle of a cornfield? And remember, we was talking to each other and we'd go with the camera back and forth and I would talk to him and he'd talk back. And then it got to the point he was going back to Altraw and going to see our granddaddy, Sagebrush Mantell. So, and I'll see you. And he left and that was the end of it. Never saw him again. But I love to do stuff that way because people, they enjoy it and they can kind of get into it. Plus, you got another character to draw from.
Who was the best? I think I might have asked this before, but I'm going to ask this a slightly different way. Who was the best mass wrestler at registering, at selling without the facial expressions? Who sold the best without having to use their face?
There's been quite a few of them. Wrestling 2, Mr. Wrestling 2. Of course, I don't much like him, but he was good. And one of the assassins, Jody Hamilton, because he would get hit in the ribs, he'd walk around and his face always stayed the same, but his hand was on his side where he got hit. And there's been a few more, probably Wrestling 1 that had to be like that. But you don't see a lot of the masked wrestlers now, unless they're Mexican. And they do so much stuff, you don't know what they're selling. Mm. If they would slow down and sell something, it might mean a little more. But I don't know how you tell them to do that. That's not their style, and they're going to do what they want to do because that's what got them there.
Next question. I've totally messed his name. I think it's Devin Thomas, Harrisburg, PA. Hey, Dutch and James, real quick, I have to tell you that Zeb Coulter had my dad and I saying "We the People" as an in-joke for years, so thanks for giving us that. Regardless, I have a few questions for you about your time as Zeb. We've talked, and I've taken out one of the questions because we've already addressed it with Alberto Del Rio and how you got hooked up with him. But the second question was between Jack Swagger, Cesaro, and Del Rio, who do you think had the most potential in the business, and did they squander it? I'd assume Cesaro, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. So there you go.
Now he's saying, what is this guy's name?
Devin Thomas. So he's saying that all three of them squandered something of their careers at one point. Do you agree?
Well, you could actually say that for all of them, really. But I think my answer to this would be Del Rio. Del Rio was his own worst enemy. And getting with that girl, what was her name?
Well, she's Soraya now, but Paige at the time.
No, Paige. And she's Soraya now.
Soraya, I'm sorry. And that's how it's
Soraya. And anyway, I think that was his downfall right there. Because he was very, very jealous of her. And from what I've heard, she was very, very jealous of him. And they both like to, drink. So put them together, two volatile personalities, and add some liquor in, and you had some problems. I think Del Rio had more of a future than Jack and Claudio Cesaro in WWE because well, they just did. But I think Jack would have went a lot farther had I not gotten hurt. And when I started going to the ring with him, it took an element of his presentation away, and maybe he didn't ever recover from it. But I never recovered from it. But Del Rio, him being Hispanic, I mean, he had who is the Hispanic in WWE now?
Well, there's loads, really. I mean, there's Damian Mysterio. Priest and Mysterio and Dominic
Damian
Mysterio,
Priest.
Carlito, all of the LWO, of course.
Yeah, but at the time, they didn't have all that. Huh. And Del Rio, if he'd have straightened up and flown right, as my grandmammy used to say, he could have done a hell of a lot more because he spoke the language and he... His family was in the business in Mexico for years and years and years. And he was a kind of a good talker, plus a great worker. He was good. But I would think of all the three of them, I think all three of them got hurt. I mean, professionally or in the business. But I think who got hurt the most was Del Rio.
I think with the other two, Jack and Cesaro, you can say that was a booking thing.
It was. But see, the booking thing, you're only going to get a booking thing if you show them something. Cesaro was a great worker, but they looked at him like he was flat. How do we make this guy a star? Nothing against him. He was great, but they didn't see it in him. And in Jack, they didn't see it either because Jack has trouble doing an interview. And when they put me with him, that went out the window. And then you got to consider the time. It was like 2013, 2014. The Republicans were coming back. I forgot the name of the group they were trying to get.
The Tea Party, I think, at the time.
Party. And we were fitting into that. I used to go out like The Rock went out on Raw in Philadelphia and attack the people. He went out there and he said, this is the largest number of trailer park trash ever assembled in one building. And when you attack them, they're ready to go for you. And that's what I'd do. I'd go out and attack the people and got a lot of response. But back to the question, yeah, I think it was... my friend, Del Rio.
Is it true that you pitched once to turn Cesaro into a James Bond-like character?
Well, this was when they had nothing to do. They had nothing to do with him. They took him away from me and Jack and put him with Paul Heyman And I asked why, and they said, well, to get some heat on him. I says, I didn't say nothing, believe me. Because sometimes knowing too much will get you booted out the door. I wanted to say we could get heat on him now if you had any sense. But guess what? I zipped it up and says, hey, we could do something with him right now. And I said, why don't you do this? Why don't you make him a James Bond character, like a 007? And he would fit that. I don't know how they would have fit it in, but he would have kind of fit into that mode. But Jack and Cesaro were just getting their legs underneath them when they pulled us apart. That's what the bad thing about, you know, you've heard me preach time and time again about patience. You got to have patience with these guys. You can't put them out there one day and expect the people to damn storm the gates. Or you can't put them out there two times and expect them to riot. Or you got to build it. And with those two teams, if I had Jack and Cesaro, I could have got some heat on them. Big time heat. But it would have been a slow process, more like the process of what Rock does and WWE does now. Because in going slow, you don't overrun where you should be, and you're always short of where you want to be, so you still got more to go. But if you run past that, you may have all damaged the angle beyond repair. So take your time with it. Be patient with it a little at a time, and we'll take it from there. They didn't seem to understand that. I didn't expect them to understand it because – see, when you're talking to creative writers, they're not bookers. They just want to know something that they can get by this interview with. And that's what I dealt with them for. I tried to deal with some of the creative agents, but they had so much on them with Vince and they didn't want to hear it.
With the Bond character, was it just, did it only get as far as the suit, or, you know, with the dicky bow and the tuxedo kind of thing, or did you actually lay out certain extra?
No, I just said let's put him out, let's figure out a way that he can be the James Bond character. Nothing else, drive up in one of those cars they would drive, and he'd get out and go into the building. If nothing else, show him a couple of times before he gets there. Now they're expecting this guy. Who is he? Then he goes to the ring, and his name is Bond, James Bond. Mm-hmm. Well, it wouldn't be that, but it would be similar to that, and do something with him there. I don't ask me what. I don't know. It never got that far.
Next question, John Zelensky. Hello, James and Dutch. Just recently started watching the podcast and absolutely loved the show. My question is, do you foresee a new type of dark supernatural character on the horizon in the wrestling world? With the passing of Bray Wyatt, wrestling lost what was the new otherworldly legend in the making. A torchbearer of sorts for The Undertaker and to even some extent the older Kevin Sullivan. These types of characters draw huge audiences as people are infatuated with what they cannot explain and are drawn to the paranormal. Thank you for the opportunity and I will continue to tune in. So Bray obviously can't do it now, but dark characters.
Well, I think now is they want positive instead of negative. Negative can come in at any time. But right now they want the people to be up with normal things, normal wrestling. And when they put a lot of time and effort into the Undertaker or the Bray Wyatt characters. I read the other day that the Undertaker thought that Brock Lesnar wasn't the ideal choice to beat him and break his record. Mm-hmm. He thought Bray Wyatt should have done it. And I'm thinking, I don't follow that at all. Because if I had to pick one or two, I would have picked Brock. But that whole Undertaker thing, it went for 20-something years, right?
Oh, yeah.
And it was kind of bought and sold for 20-something years. But I think if I was Vince, and I know Vince is weird, if I had had to do anything with Undertaker, I would have done anything else except break the record. That was a record that belonged to the fans. And now we see that he lost it to Brock Lesnar. How good did that do him when he broke it?
I think people forget with Brock Lesnar was that he'd actually lost quite a lot in the run-up to that.
Yeah, but it did. I don't think it helped him.
I think it helped Brock, but not nearly as much as it hindered The Undertaker in that sense. But I do think it helped Brock.
That's what I'm saying. It hurt Undertaker more than it helped Brock.
Well, okay, here's a question then. So you don't think Bray Wyatt was the right person. You don't think Brock Lesnar was the right person. If Undertaker had to lose, it could be 10 years ago, it could be a couple of years ago when he last wrestled, I don't know, AJ Styles. Who's the person who you think would have benefited the most and deserved it the most?
I'm going to say it off the top of my head. I don't think anybody at that time. Brock was the number one guy. And it didn't help him because the people were disappointed when he lost. They will come. I've said this before. They'll come to see the babyface win. They don't like to come when the heel wins. They just don't like that. And Brock didn't have heat. It was more like, oh God, now what do we do now? It's more like disillusionment they were confused on it. And we're not going to cheer him that because he has an 0-1 with Undertaker. But I do think that was a down point of WrestleMania. And it wasn't even a controversial finish. He just got beat. But they didn't want to see that record go away.
Next question. Aaron Smith says, this seems to have gone under a lot of people's radars, but Uncle Howdy's been putting out promos on YouTube for months on the channel Dreadmare. Thought you all might be interested in looking into these because I haven't seen a whole lot of people reporting on them. Always a fan. I don't remember if we talked about this last week because, as I say, my brain has smoothed over.
What's the name of his podcast or whatever it is?
A YouTube channel called Dreadmare, which I'm unfamiliar with. So apparently
Dreadmare.
Uncle Howdy has been putting out, or someone has been putting out Uncle Howdy promos for months now. So did we talk about this last week with...
I think maybe.
Yeah.
You said you were going to have something on it or something.
I don't have anything on it.
Okay.
I just so
hey, I'm not it. I'm not a... To me, angles like that are characters like that, like Undertaker, even Bray Wyatt and Howdy, they're gimmicks. Undertaker just happened to take over because of Vince. And don't forget, Vince was the reason WWE is in the position it is right now. Because he ran the company pretty good. Even versus his extracurricular activities. But I don't think how he could hold the people's interest with those characters. I don't know how you tell a story with them. I mean, you can try to tell a story, but it is a story, but it's not a story. The only story that will work is he's got to have a conflict with another super being. And they never really had that long term. So I don't know what to do.
But I loved Undertaker and Kane. I loved that as a kid. And that was sort of as close
But hey, what did they have?
They had the family thing as well.
Right. They had a story.
So you can relate to it.
Okay. If Kane had just shown up, you know, and doing the fire and all, you go, what the hell? But he had a story that he was the brother of Undertaker. And now it's a family thing. It's a family tradition that they had extra powers and all. I can kind of see that. Had great matches, and you can kind of see it.
I am your brother. You should have started off with that. That'd be cool. Right, we'll move on. Tim from Mobile, Alabama. Or it's Mobile, isn't it, how you pronounce it, I guess?
Mobile.
Wondering if Mr. Mantell had any good Gerald Briscoe stories from the road. Loved the podcast. Now, I should briefly say that we have told the story a couple of times where he broke up the fight between you and Lars Anderson. So other than that, do you have any good old Jerry Briscoe stories?
Well, did I tell the story about Ernie Ladd?
And Jerry?
Yeah.
I don't think so, no.
All right, settle down, kids. Pull up a chair. Throw a log on the fire. Jerry and Jack Briscoe were co-owners at Championship Wrestling from Florida. And one night we went to Jacksonville, and I went with Ernie. Because Ernie liked me, and he would take a little Cessna plane, and he would contract that to fly him to Jacksonville because he didn't want to ride 250 miles or 260 miles on a Thursday, and I didn't either. So sometimes he would let me fly for $25. Sometimes he would let me fly for $0. But he liked to talk to me, and he enjoyed, you know, our conversation. And I really enjoyed talking to him. So he had made a deal with Eddie Graham that he would make X number of dollars if he came to Florida. Well, he came to Florida and he wasn't making exactly what the agreement was. This was before contracts, but he wasn't making anywhere close to what he thought he should make. Let's just make, put a figure on it. Back in those days, $1,500. Well, he may have been making $1,100, but not to $1,500. But what would happen is that what he was lacking would be bonus to him on the same check, but he's not getting it. So he wanted to leave, and he says, and he did it right by the book. He gave his notice. He was going to leave. And all he asked them to do was don't put a camera in any of these arenas because he didn't want it recording him losing to anybody. And that was a standard practice back in those days because, you know, he didn't want that showing in Japan. He didn't want it showing in Texas. He didn't want it showing in Vince McMahon land, nowhere. Because it showed him losing, and he didn't want to see that. So he went to Jacksonville, and I was on early, and I got back, and I got dressed, and they come in, and they said, you're on next. And he had told me all this that afternoon, I think. But he went out there, and he was back in like 7 minutes. And he was against, I think, Jerry Briscoe or Jack, one of them. And he was back. And I went, what happened? And he says, let's go. Let's get out of here. And we got in the car. I didn't know what was going on. We got in the car and he called a cab, took us back to the airport. It wasn't the airport. It was a private, you know, airfield. And he told me on the way out there, he said, I told them not to have any cameras there. He said, I'll put over anybody they want me to put over. Just don't put it on tape and we're fine. But he looked up and the red light on the camera was on. He said, whoop, I told him not to. He just hit the floor and kept walking to the dressing room. It's supposed to be like a 20-minute match, but it was only 7 because he cut it short and got in the car and they were mad as hell about it. So as we're riding back, now he's talking more and more and more. And he says, I forgot how we ended up over there. No, he took me to my car, right? And then he called home and his wife told him that the Briscoe had called and they want to meet with him tonight. So after he dropped me out, which was somewhere north of Tampa, he drove down to the Sportatorium. And the Sportatorium didn't have a parking lot. It had like, well, it did, but it was sand. And so he told me this the next day. Well, let me tell you, the next day I got a call about 9 o'clock, and it was Brian, I can't remember his last name now, but he said, did you hear what, no, it was Mike Graham. He said, you hear what happened to the Briscoes and Ernie? I went, no, What happened? You hadn't heard about it? No. He said, well, you will. And what had happened, Ernie, they had sent him word. He had called them. And they said, meet us down at the office. Because they flew back too. Meet us back at the office and we'll discuss this. He said, okay. So he was going down and he said, I pulled up in the close to the office right there in front of that parking lot. And there they were. They were out walking, smoking the doobie. And he said, okay. And he said he got out of the car and he said they were so, they were really upset. They were fit to be tied, he said. You son of a bitch, you MF-er, this, that, and the other. Why in the hell did you do that up there? Blah, 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 blah. He said, whoa, guys. Calm down. He said, listen, why don't we smoke a doobie? Then let's talk about it. Well, yeah, they wanted a doobie. So he got him another doobie. And I don't know if they were smoking before he got there or not. They liked the doobie. So they got out and they started smoking the joints. And they started talking about it. And they both got in front of him. And one went around behind him. And he said, uh-oh, now I know what's going to happen. So he said, wait a minute, guys. Wait a minute. He got in the trunk of his car where he said the doobie was and pulled out a lug wrench. And he says, one grabbed him from the front, one grabbed him from the back. And when he went to hit Jerry, I think Jerry was in the back. Rest in peace, Jerry. He hit Jerry.
Jerry's alive. Jack died.
Oh, Jack died. Jack took it in the head, I think knocked him out. And then Jerry took it front ways, knocked him out. Now he's got two lifeless, damn near Briscoes that were bleeding like damn, like a waterfall. And he said he picked them up, threw them in the trunk of his car, not even the back seat, threw them in the trunk, closed the lid, and drove them to a hospital, got up to the hospital, opened the trunk, got them out, and, you know, they were sitting there. He didn't throw them. They weren't still knocked out, but they were really goofy. Put them there and drove off. No police was there, nobody, nothing. And he said that was the end of it. Now, they've since made up since then, but that was what happened to Ernie Ladd and the Briscoes. And Jerry was a part of it.
Did Ernie ever work for Florida and Eddie Graham again after that?
No, it was getting ready to fold up at that time. This was, I mean, WWE was so strong. They weren't drawing. And what WWE had done was raided the territory like they did everywhere else. You know, they raided Texas, and they took Kerry Von Erich. They took the top one, and they raided Florida. They took Dusty, and they took a lot of them. And a lot of places, they just took the top names because they'd make more money in WWF. And Florida was closing up and losing money. So it probably stayed in business about another year or so.
We shall move on. Helen Smith says, do you have any memories of working with Matt Bourne? A little research says that you had one of Matt's, as well as your own, final matches in 2010, when he once again donned the makeup for the Doink the Clown character. I've heard that Matt was as tough as he was just an absolute pain in the ass to deal with and was one of wrestling's true characters. Love the show, guys.
Yeah, I had a run-in with Matt Bourne in the ring.
You did?
Yeah.
A legitimate run-in?
Yeah.
Okay.
Nothing happened. He beat shit out of me. But I was playing with him one day. He was doing that mountain character or whatever it was. Or
it's WCW. So yeah. Big Josh. Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah, it was that. And I was untying his shoelace, and he didn't like it. And I went to do something else. Marty had me to move. I was playing with his, you know, and he's trying to stop it. And finally, he just got up and he said, don't do it. God damn it. I went, whoa, okay. I got you, brother. No, he didn't do it. But then the match ended. And I thought that he wasn't one to kid around with. He had a bad, bad temper. Really bad temper, as I found out. But And then he apologized later on, you know, I don't like that kind of stuff and stuff, you know, but I thought he would really, because I didn't know what to do with him. He's supposed to be the big Josh from the woods and whatever this, and trying to get his gimmick over. And I don't know what he did, but he didn't like that at all. But yeah, and I heard a lot of stories about him later. He, something that he did in Memphis, he was at a bar or something. He beat somebody up or, but stories about him beating people up aren't rare. Because he had a bad temper and he'd reach over and he'd pop somebody real quick. So, but I was wondering, what would he do if he popped one of the guys, like the, who's the tough Samoan guys?
Oh, well, there's so many of them. Which ones, like Rikishi or Yoko?
Well, not Rikishi.
The Wild
not
Samoans?
Yoko. No, not them. It was another one. Another two, I think.
Oh, God.
But anyway, I wondered, wonder what would happen if he touched them. So that would have been a hell of a fight.
With Matt Bourne, so I, as people, I'm sure a lot of people who watch this know, I used to do a podcast with Don Morocco, and he said there was two people. Of all the interviews that I ever did with him, all the podcasts, he said there were only ever two people he just couldn't stand, and one was Ole Anderson, and yep, one was Matt Bourne. But his mm-hmm. problem with Matt Bourne was that Don had rented a car, and then he lent it to Matt, and then Matt borrowed it and trashed it, and then didn't even pay him back for it. Just stuck him with the insurance, like uninsured bill, I guess.
Well, that sounds like something that he would do, but that's just everyday fare for the wrestling business. The wrestling business today is now beyond that, I would hope. Because WWE, you got to sign a 3-year contract with them to work there. Before, no, you could just come in on a handshake. And guess what WWE could do with it? They could just all of a sudden let you go. No 2 weeks, no nothing. Just say, well, we're not booking you anymore. Sorry. And they'd get out of it. So I can't remember the other two, but they were really... One of them went in a bar in Nashville and cleaned the whole bar out. He beat the hell out of the whole bar about 2 o'clock in the morning. And the police came and said, who is it? And they said, him. They said, okay, you guys need to go on home. Because we're going to go down here to the Waffle House and have a little breakfast. And they let him go.
Do you remember this, excuse me, 2010 match you had with Matt Bourne as Doink the Clown?
2010.
Yeah, so this would be the very tail end of your in-ring career.
Where was it?
I'll find out 1 second, pausing. Okay, so it was in, let me just crane in here, Freehold, New Jersey. Any memories of this at all? Ah, well.
No memories of that at all. No, seriously. I've never, when you said Rehold, I went, what, Arkansas? It sounded like an Arkansas name.
Freehold, New Jersey. New Jersey, yeah.
Nope, I don't remember that at all.
There you go. Right, we've got a couple more in this, I think, before we end. Tim Davis writes in and says, with questions for Dutch at gmail.com, it seemed like every 3 or so weeks the Gibson brothers were beaten to a bloody pulp on TV. Were they gluttons for punishment or on somebody's bad list? I'm editing bad language out there. One last question. Did Paul Morton possess the fastest 3 count in wrestling business? I appreciate your time and attention on these matters, and good life and health in your future. So, the Gibson brothers and their apparent love for getting beaten up on TV every 3 weeks.
I think he's got that confused with somebody else.
Oh, yeah?
I remember the Gibson brothers as being a credible tag team.
Well, maybe they were, maybe and, in an angle, they were beaten down in that sense.
Well, I don't know. I've never seen him beaten down like that. And Ricky died. Ricky died. I don't know, before 1980. I know. I think.
No,
didn't he?
He retired around then, but I think he died a bit later.
When's his last match?
82, I think. Yeah, he was in Jarrett's promotion in 1982, and then. I don't know when he died. Oh, I'm sorry. He died in 2006 of a heart attack. Mm-hmm. So there you go. He retired in 15
years. Well, I don't remember them getting beat down. I remember them because they were too good. They were really good in the ring. If you want somebody to beat down, get rough and ready. I mean, because, you know, they are what they were. And Rick and Robert, they could do some really good stuff. So, and what was the last part of that question?
Well, before we go to that, let's stick with Ricky Gibson for a minute. So my understanding is, I mean, I've interviewed Ricky. I even met Ricky Morton in real life. He's taller than I thought he'd be, Ricky. I thought he'd be like 5'8". He's more like 5'10". Anyway.
You're talking about Ricky Morton.
Yeah. Sorry, I met Ricky Morton. When I interviewed him, he always said that Ricky Gibson was so good that he could have been, or even was in contention to be NWA champion at one point.
Well, he was good, and he was just a natural. He could do things, I mean, with ease. Ricky's problem was drinking, and possibly drugs too. But he was, the last couple of times I saw him, he was like drunk as hell, and still working. I didn't like to work with people who were drunk because they were, you know, they weren't themselves, and who knows what could happen. But I don't remember, but I do remember that he was very, very good. And if he had cleaned himself up a little bit and went to the gym a little more, I think he would have been at least a challenge for the title. And I think he probably had a couple of bouts for the world title down in the Pensacola territory.
It says here that the pair of Ricky and Robert Gibson, or Reuben Gibson at the time, often teamed up until a car accident forced Ricky to temporarily retire in 1982. Struck head-on by a drunk driver, you were saying that, Ricky, he was cut from the wreckage by firefighters with a metal rod stuck in his leg. It says stick. He returned to Memphis briefly at the end of 1983 before retiring. He also wrestled under the name Ricky Lee Jones in 1987 before being done for good.
I never remember him wrestling as Ricky Lee Jones. I don't even know where that come from. Never even heard that.
Mid-Atlantic in 87. So the same year you were partially there and you left. So maybe your ships in the night passed in that sense. Okay, we've got...
Let me ask you something. Okay, yes, was Ricky Gibson.
Okay.
And he goes to Charlotte territory, Mid-Atlantic. What was the purpose of changing his name to Ricky Lee Jones?
Maybe he was just disabled in some way and wasn't as good as he used to be. I mean, if you got like a metal rod sticking out of your leg, that was going to hamper your gait.
And what did he die of?
Didn't say. He said around 55. Heart attack. But I'm sorry, 53.
Heart
2006.
Attack. Okay. And he was 55 years old?
53.
Okay.
So apparently Ricky Lee Jones, he was in Mid-Atlantic the same time you were, very briefly. Tim Horner beat him. Okay, I'm going to blow your mind now. The Kansas Jayhawks defeat Ricky Lee Jones and Shaska Watley in Richmond, Virginia. Apparently he wrestled in 87.
I don't think that was him.
No?
Nope.
Right, okay.
I'm pretty sure it wasn't him. So you tell those bastards that write that that crap on that site, Ricky Lee Jones, I kind of remember the name, but it wasn't Ricky Gibson. Ricky Gibson, I think, was totally through with the ring.
It also says that you teamed with him and beat him in a singles match on this. So
I teamed with who?
Ricky Lee Jones.
No, I think it's somebody else.
Right, we're going to have to find this out. Okay, Sleuth, is there any footage of Dutch or even Ricky Lee Jones in Mid-Atlantic we'd like to know? But it says NWA World Championship Wrestling TV show from the WTBS studios in Atlanta, Georgia, 21st of February, 1987. Can someone find out if that's the actual Ricky Gibson? We'd like to know. We're going to ask one more question. And we're going to...
That's 36 years ago.
I know.
Damn.
It's not a criticism.
But now I'm going to go on record as saying, I don't think that was him. And I like 1987, though, I think Ricky wouldn't want to do that anyway.
Well, I bet that'll be on the network as well, so we'll have a look for it. Okay, this is the last question, then we're going to close down this here.
Wait a minute. Why did these wrestling logs have so many mistakes in them?
I don't know.
I don't know either. Because who gives them this?
Now, this is from a TV show. So they've written down the results from that. But then there's a house show.
Okay, if he'd have been Ricky Lee Jones, okay, you would have, we would have to see, he would have his list of bookings from that year. I don't think that was Ricky. I really don't.
Okay, we'll investigate. I promise you we will.
Okay, Ricky Lee Jones, that was the same time the Rock and Roll were there.
Yeah.
Which now makes a little sense, but it doesn't make sense. See what I mean?
Do you want me to see if I can find the episode?
No.
All right.
I'm not that crazy about it.
No, okay. Right. Final question of the episode, then we're going to shut down. Spencer Yates says, "Hello, Dutch and James. Over the years, it's become extremely obvious that Ric Flair is a classic fair weather fan. He will support whatever sports team's hot at the moment or whatever team is paying him to appear or at least is being nice to him at that moment. He has no brand loyalty to any sports team who may be rebuilding or struggling. I think he uses this approach in business as well as life. He wants to jump on to what is the hot product." I mean, in fairness, you can't blame him for that, I guess. This brings me to AEW. Ric Flair seemed to be desperate to get to AEW when they were new hot products, even though WWE under Vince had spent years rebuilding him and would use him just to give him a payday. He had no loyalty to WWE. Ric Flair is now in AEW and pretty much does nothing, and the product is just flat and the company is just down right now. WWE is on fire and seems to be getting better and better. My question for you is, do you think Ric Flair will try and get himself out of AEW to jump over to WWE while they are the hot thing? Or do you think he will try to help out the struggling upstart AEW or just take a paycheck and do nothing?
Ric Flair couldn't help AEW if his life depended on it. Because Ric Flair is 75 years old. He doesn't appeal to the young demographic anymore. Hell, I appeal to them more than he does. But the only reason he's there is because he sell the woo drink to them.
Yes, so I mean, he
and
basically
I
got
think
that for
they
free.
Pick up his salary,
yeah,
and he just got to be around. Actually, excuse me, if he don't want to do something, he can just tell him, "No, I'm not doing it." So it's not like they're his boss. The Woo Drink Company is his boss, and all they do is show their ad and pay Rick. So whatever that is, and I haven't seen him in months.
No, Sting, he was hanging about Sting, and now Sting's retired. He's retired again, I guess. He's not been seen.
Yep, well, I thought, did he get used in that last match?
He did. I think he did, very fleetingly. And then he swore in the camera. And that was about
it. That bastard. But see, they do things in AEW. I don't know what they do. I don't know what rhyme or reason they do it for. Apparently, just the hot thought of the night before. I don't know. So, but Flair is a con man. He really is. I've had my dealings with him. I had him one in Puerto Rico with him.
Wow, that was with David Flair, wasn't it?
That was David Flair. Yeah. I booked him, and he said, if you'll book him, and I'll make a short story short, if you'll book him, I'll make two appearances for you at a reasonable price. I said, okay. And I booked him because Carlos didn't like him much. And I said, yeah, but we got that Flair deal. And I think he told Rick, David one day, hey, just pack up and leave. And he did. They went to get him for the show and he was gone. No notice, no nothing. So.
You know, you're not the only person to say that around this time, hey, book David Flair for us, my son for me, and I'll appear for you. Was it Dory Funk or someone like that, I think, who did the same thing, and Ric Flair obviously never showed up. Loyalty, so that's an interesting attack that Spencer Yates, or claim that Spencer Yates is making against Ric Flair. Has Ric Flair just got no loyalty to anybody? Is it just whoever
Nobody.
Will pay him?
Rick is for Rick. I don't blame him. But, you know, if you meet Rick, he'll make you think you're the greatest friend he's ever found. And then make you feel, but you'll end up paying for the drinks. And I can kind of see that, too. You get to hang out with Ric Flair if you're a fan for a couple of hours. That's, you know, should be worth a few drinks to you anyway. But, and if you come up to him later, hey, Rick, remember me? No. And he just go on. He's very, very rude when he doesn't want to participate in a conversation. I've seen him do it. But I've seen him do it in the dressing room, too. People get tired of that crap, you know. I mean, if somebody is a fan of mine comes up, hey, I used to watch you, blah, 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 blah. Thank you very much, blah. And I remember this one match, even a match I don't remember. I said, oh, yeah, I remember that one. That was a tough one. But you got to make them feel as though, you know, you recognize and appreciate the contribution they've made towards your career. They bought a ticket. What else I expect them to do? Cut my grass? But it's very easy to say, thank you very much, and I hope you enjoyed it. Oh, I did. And talk to them like, you know, like a person. And they remember that. But Rick, he would go on some of us bullshit and just cut them off and walk away. Well, that's the feeling he leaves them with. He left them and just standing there like a jack-off, and they will always remember that. But if you're friendly to them, make them feel like they're part of the club, if only for 30 seconds or a minute, because you don't have a lot of time anyway, they'll remember that.
Do you, there's two things I'll mention. Do you remember there was a quote that I gave you like a year or so ago, and Ric Flair said he only had three real friends, Conrad Thompson, Vince McMahon, and Hulk Hogan. And he said because those three will give him money and never ask for it back.
Well, they'd be my best friends too. Yeah, I said, hey, let me look at my friends list, see if it's gone down. Conrad, Vince, and Hulk Hogan.
Hey, well, Vince is rich at the moment.
Oh, yeah.
He's got another 311.
Yeah. You know I mean? Now, Vince likes him. Mm. And who was the other one?
Conrad Thompson and Hulk Hogan.
Conrad Thompson, yeah. And Conrad, he married his daughter. So that's his father-in-law. Mm. And Vince and Hulk Hogan. Vince, I don't know, would be so, I don't know if Vince would be so obliging. Or even Hulk now. When did he say this?
Oh, this was before the Vince, this is before the, probably before the NDA thing came out. I'm not absolutely sure, but I think it probably was. Well, it was definitely before the Janelle Grant thing came out. There was one more thing I was going to bring. Oh, yeah, there was the other story as well. Speaking about Rick and money, it's stories that I've heard before. I didn't hear it at WrestleCon when I was there. But Ric Flair, when he sees that he's got a very, very long line at one of these conventions, all of a sudden his signature will be worth $50. Let's say it starts up at $50, and all of a sudden it goes up to 60, then it goes up to 80, then it goes up to 100. And he'll just essentially charge whatever he thinks he can. And he's not the only wrestler to do that. But Rick is well-known.
Does he advertise $50 or $60 or $70 or $80? Or what does he advertise?
I think it's one of those things where, because I've heard this before, people send him pre-orders for a certain price and then he won't give it unless they pay the rest.
That's not right. See, that just shows you what kind of damn carny environment he was brought up in. Just do what you want to do whenever you want to do it and screw them if they don't like it. And with Vince now, screw him if they don't like it, has more meaning because hell, he could be dead tomorrow. So what difference does it make? If they're willing to pay it, I'm willing to take it. So, but I wouldn't do that. I've actually had people come up there and they didn't have the money and I would just give it to them. You know how much an 8x10 cost?
Nothing, almost.
Nothing, about 50 cents, 60 cents maybe. It's your autograph that's worth something. So you own that, so just give it to them. If they can get some money out of it, fine. I don't care. But and a lot of people, I've said something about this a couple of weeks ago. You know, guys on the streets, homeless, begging for money, The old saying, there but for the grace of God go I. It could be me sitting there. I hope not, but it could have been. And these guys had a lot of, so if you got, a lot of them are homeless vets, and I've said this before. If you got a few dollars, guys, people, just help them out just a little bit, because he'll will appreciate it. It doesn't hurt you that much. You don't even have to know him. Just help him out, and he'll say thank you, because some of those people on the street are the nicest people in the world. I've heard of one guy, he was starving. A guy got him something to eat, and another homeless guy come up and sat down beside him, and he gave half his food to the other guy because he's hungry too, which to me is the way to share it, but they can do what they want to do. But let's help out when we can. Flair, on the other hand, he's above that. He wouldn't do that.
There we go. Yeah, exactly. Help out when you can, and that's a nice message to leave this podcast on. So, for now, thank you everybody for watching. We'll be back on Friday for Story Time with Dutch Mantel, the regular episode.
This is a good one.
Do you know, I think this was a really good one. I really liked every answer as well. We need to find out the Ricky Gibson thing, though. That's going to bug me. It won't bug you, well, but it'll bug me.
Oh, it's bugging me right now.
Is it really?
I think Ricky Lee Jones rings a bell. If I knew Robert's phone number, I would call him up. I may call Ricky Morton and ask him.
Okay. I'll do you one better. Just give me 1 minute. I'm going to find out. So, after we actually found the episode, look at this. It is indeed Ricky Gibson as Ricky Lee Jones, and you are teaming with him. So, you just no memory of this at all?
Brother, no, I have no memory of it. He wasn't there long.
Oh, no, he wasn't there long.
Not that would have mattered, but since I didn't wrestle him, there's Brad. He's gone. Ricky's gone.
That's not Brad, is it?
I'm over there by myself. First, Jaggers is not there.
Here we go. No, I think it's just a book because Bob's there. So there you go. That's
well,
Ricky
you never
Gibson.
See that. You never see that again. Look at there. Yeah, get your ass down, boy. Okay, I don't know where Jaggers would have been. Okay, in my corner, they're all dead.
Yeah, I guess so.
Except for me.
In the other corner, I don't
feel so damn good myself.
that's not Brad Armstrong though. Who's the other guy?
No, that is Brad. That's Bob.
Yeah, Bob Armstrong. But there's a
and
guy
Bob and Ole. Here we go. God damn it, sell it. Here we go. Oh my God. Do they want me to? Now they're beating the crap out of me, those bastards. But these guys knew what they were doing, so.
There we go.
Except Lex. He didn't know what he was doing. Oh. But that's why they put him in there with those guys who do know what they're doing, so they can keep him out of the ring more.
There you go.
So, but that was, I'm glad you, I kind of had an inkling that Ricky Lee Jones, because I remember thinking, wait a minute, why did he change his name? And I have no idea. I'm back to where I started.
Well, at least we know that he was there for a bit, and he did a bits and bobs in the 80s.
But if I had been on, a guest show for money,
Jeopardy.
I would have said, no, absolutely, it's not Ricky Gibson.
There you go, then, right? Okay, so that is the end of the podcast. I'm starving. I'm going now. So thank you, everybody, for watching. Questions for Dutch at gmail.com. If you want to be involved with next week's episode, we will see you again on Friday for Storytime with Dutch Mantel. And Dutch, we the people.